It is Tuesday, August 30th here in Washington, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin. In the next half hour, the Islamic State militant group says one of its top members has been killed. Why would they admit that? I'll ask our national security correspondent. We'll explore why Turkey is nervous about Islamic State losses along its border with Syria. We'll also preview President Obama's trip to Asia later this week, and and Alicia Cara makes a statement about what it takes to be beautiful with this new song. It's all ahead on International Edition. The Islamic State says its second-ranking leader has been killed in Syria's Aleppo province. The militant group used its news outlet Amaq to make Tuesday's announcement about Abu Muhammad al-Adnani, who served as its chief propagandist and also was involved in recruiting activities and attacks in Europe. Amaq said Adnani was killed while surveying IS operations to repel military campaigns against Aleppo, but gave few other details. For more on why the Islamic State group would make such a revelation, I spoke to VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden.
It's not all that surprising. Some of the most recent top Islamic State officials who have been killed in U.S. airstrikes or otherwise, the Islamic State through Amaq and other channels, Amaq being its news agency, has been trying of late to get out ahead, to announce the news first. Could be various reasons why, but it's been a trend that the U.S. has not been announcing it. Also, remember, the U.S. has been burned, as have other coalition members, in prematurely announcing the death of key Islamic State leaders, officials, commanders, some of whom have been killed, you know, numerous times before they're actually dead. So what happens when there's an airstrike or there's an action that could have resulted in the death of the leader? The U.S. has been very careful, both on the military side, the intelligence side, in vetting it, trying to make sure that the target they think they killed is actually dead. So the fact that it was announced by Amaq, not surprising at all. It's always possible, of course, that this is a misdirection play by Islamic State. No indication that that's the case, but there have been other times where key terror leaders have tried to fake their own death or convince the world of their own death so they could continue to fly under the radar. So it's still very early on. The fact that the announcement has not come yet from the U.S., not surprising. One other thing to consider, I spoke earlier with a U.S. official who confirmed to me that the U.S. had been tracking several what they call high-value individuals, HVIs, in Aleppo province in Syria. Was Adnani possibly one of the people on that list? It is possible, though we don't have confirmation of that.
Well, what is the significance of this IS militant Adnani to the organization?
Well, he in a way is the voice of Islamic State. He was their top spokesman. But beyond that, he's even more important. And he was one of their senior leaders with the group really since the beginning, part of a core of leadership that had been detained by the U.S. in Iraq back when AQI, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, first burst onto the scene. He knew a lot. He had a lot of connections. There was a lot of reporting that his role was much deeper than just being a spokesman, that he was part of also the external operations planning division, which, of course, would tie together both the spokesperson duties, but also the terror attack duties, specifically targeting the West. A lot of times he would be the one speaking on propaganda, talking about how a certain Western country would be targeted, which then followed up occasionally by an attack on that country.
What are your sources saying about, you know, the significance of the death of a militant like this to the group? Because the group has suffered territorial losses in Syria and Iraq. But in one of his last messages, Adnani actually said, "Do you think, America, that defeat is by the loss of towns or territory?" He asked, "Were we defeated when we lost the cities in Iraq and retreated to the desert without city or land?" No, he said, "the true defeat is losing the will and desire to fight." And it seems like many IS militants still have that desire. So, you know, what kind of impact could this have?
Well, one of the things that intelligence and military officials have long said about Islamic State is that it is very adept at adjusting to situations. It is flexible, it is adaptable, and it is resilient. So it finds a way to overcome these losses. One of the things that was noted early on was just simply the group's leadership structure, in which it seemed like no one individual ever knew too much and easily could be replaced by somebody lower down in the ranks. To some extent, that still exists. At the same time, however, military officials are very clear, and the commander of U.S. Central Command, who oversees U.S. forces in the region, helping lead the coalition effort against Islamic State, said earlier that the coalition is now really pushing into the heart of the caliphate, and that the group is facing pressures like it has not seen before. It does not have good choices it can make on one hand or the other. So there's a sense that Islamic State is on the retreat, that it is receding. But intelligence officials and the military equally adamant that a loss on the battlefield does not mean the defeat of the group, and that the group has always been most effective, most dangerous when it uses asymmetric tactics, terrorist tactics, and that it is still very much viable in that sense.
We'll have to see if that kind of strategy continues by IS. Thank you very much to our national security correspondent, Jeff Selden, for speaking to International Edition.
Anytime.
Well, it's time for a check on what is trending on social media, and Lori London is with me in the studio. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Michael.
So what have you got today?
Well, we've got a problem for a popular American musician who has had a history of having brushes with the law, Chris Brown. He's more well-known not just for his music, but his troubled history of physical abuse with former girlfriend and singer Rihanna. He's trending on Facebook and Twitter due to yet another brush with the law. TMZ reports that authorities launched a criminal assault investigation after a woman said the singer threatened her with a firearm earlier today. The woman filed a report claiming they were in an argument and he pulled out a gun. Rolling Stone, at Rolling Stone, tweeted that police actually entered his home after what officers called a long and protracted standoff. And as you can imagine, there's lots of reaction. Idol, at Iman underscore Idol, writes, Chris Brown is an abuser. Stop excusing his behavior because he's talented, y'all. Twitter user Pocahontia says, I don't believe Chris Brown accuser at all. How you gone make a video saying, you really think I would do that? Yes, we do. and then you've got TMZ also reporting that police have retrieved at least one gun, other weapons and drugs from Chris Brown's home after he apparently threw a duffel bag out the window of his home. And Val Peck, her handle is at Val Burton, tweets, I don't want Chris Brown to join the 27 Club, but I feel it could happen.
What is the 27 Club?
Well, we've had a history of celebrities in the U.S. dying at the age of 27 from drug abuse. Brown is 27 years old. He's famous, and he's had a number of issues with the law. They're referring to that long list of young American celebrities who've lost their lives to drug overdoses. By the way, Chris Brown adamantly denies any wrongdoing via his Instagram account.
Okay, thanks so much, Lori London, for that wrap of the latest Chris Brown saga. You can find Lori on Twitter at Lori London. I'm at Michael underscore Lippin. And this is VOA underscore IE. Well, the United States is expressing growing concern that two of its allies, Turkey and Syrian Kurds, are fighting each other rather than focusing on their mutual enemy, the Islamic State. White House Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes said Monday that Turkey's recent attacks on the Kurdish group Syrian Democratic Forces inside Syria will complicate efforts to create a unified front against IS. But as International Edition's Victor Beatty learned, regional analyst Alem Payand of Ohio State University believes that Turkey has good reason to be anxious about a potential Kurdish defeat of IS militants in Syria.
So Turkey is very much nervous that the gap created by the ISIL's retreat, probably the Kurdish forces will fill those areas and then will create problem for Turkey in the future. So Turkey does not want this to happen. And here is clash between the United States interests and Turkish. Because the United States is supporting the YPG, the Kurdish Protection Unit, People's Protection Unit, which is fighting against the forces of Bashar al-Assad. And Turkey also has the same objectives, but does not want the Kurdish people to take advantage of the void which will be created. There should be more communication between Turkey and the United States, how to coordinate that, so that Turkey could be convinced by diplomacy that what the United States is doing, the Kurdish groups that which the United States is supporting, are not taking advantage of the void created by ISIL's retreat Turkey is nervous, and they have the right to be that way.
You spoke about communication. President Obama will have a bilateral meeting with his Turkish counterpart, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, during the G20 summit in China next month. What might they talk about?
The United States cannot guarantee that the Kurdish forces will totally abandon anti-Turkish sentiment, and I'm certain they will find some sort of common ground.
Well, the best-case scenario for the U.S. would be for the Kurds to move to the east of the Euphrates River and for Turkey to accept U.S. assurances that the Kurds will stay there.
Yeah, that's what Turkey wants, and very little has been done to give some sort of assurances to Turkey.
And that was Alan Payand of Ohio State University speaking to my colleague Victor Beatty. Here's some of the top stories right now on VOAnews.com. India and the United States agree to intensify intelligence sharing on terrorism. Car bomb kills 20 people near Somalia's presidential palace. United States accuses Iran of provocative naval maneuvers in the Persian Gulf. Colombian President Santos sets October 2nd as the date for a national vote on a peace deal with FARC rebels. And the U.S. says it wants to complete a trade deal with the European Union by year's end. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on voanews.com. This is International Edition. Barack Obama is heading to China and Laos on what could be his final regional trip as U.S. president, to cement one of his key foreign policy goals, strengthening alliances with Asian allies of the U.S. through his Pivot to Asia strategy. But a series of U.S.-China tensions threaten to overshadow Obama's meetings with Chinese President Xi Jinping and other leaders of the Group of 20 Nations who are gathering in Hangzhou for their annual summit starting on September 4th. The summit was the focus of our hashtag VOA TV show, which I co-hosted earlier today. Our guests included Harry Kazianis, an Asia analyst at the Center for the National Interest, who joined us via Skype, and Curtis Chin, Asia fellow at the Milken Institute and former U.S. ambassador to the Asian Development Bank. In the show, I asked Curtis Chin whether he thinks the disputes about the South China Sea will cast a shadow over the G20 summit.
Yeah, I don't think it'll be overshadowed by any talk of the South China Sea, which is inevitable. Whether it's informal and outside of China or in China, clearly much of what's going to be focused on is the economic side. But there really is no separating the economic for the defense and all that is going on in China and in Asia beyond what's going on in Hangzhou this next week.
Well, how are those two things connected, the economic aspect of the summit and the tensions over the South China Sea?
I mean, just look at the South China Sea. Somewhat $5 trillion of trade goes through it. And clearly, if there's no peace in the South China Sea, it's going to disrupt trade. So clearly, again, you know, there's this artificial attempt to separate what is very much a connected issue, the South China Sea and the economics of trade and peace in that region.
So you think that even though, you know, China may not want the South China Sea to officially be on the agenda of the G20, you know, all the countries that are taking part will still want, will have in the back of their minds, we need to reduce the tensions so that, you know, trade can flow.
It might be a little bit more diplomatic. I don't know if we think back to earlier to the G7 meeting in Japan this year. It was more subtle when countries, diplomats, talked about the need for a rule of law, for peace in the region. And so perhaps on the surface it'll be very subtle. But under the surface, that tension remains and really needs to be addressed in the long run to the benefit of China and the rest of the world.
Well, Harry, I want to bring you in here to this conversation. What are your thoughts about the South China Sea as an issue hovering over the G20?
Well, I think quite simply, it's a powder keg. I think this is the international issue of the 21st century. We talk a lot about ISIS, the challenges of Ukraine, wider Middle East problems, the struggle with Iran and its nuclear program. But I think when we look at where we have problems of great power competition, where the number one, the number two, and the number three economies, specifically the United States, China, and Japan, could actually come to blows, there's no other place in the world that could trigger this except the South China Sea. I think Beijing has made it very clear through their statements of the past 5 or 6 years now that they claim the South China Sea as essentially their historic territory, their sovereign waters. In the past, there's been some instances where they've claimed it to be their core interest. So I think it's very clear that Beijing has set up a situation where they're going to have a very hard time getting out of. Keep in mind, when you make those type of claims, it does not leave leave you a lot of negotiating or bargain room to sort of dial that back. So I think in the long term, over the next 10 to 15 years, this will be a powder keg that we're going to have to watch very carefully.
And Harry, what do you think about whether the South China Sea will come up specifically in the G20? Do you anticipate any discussion on that at all?
Well, I think, like your previous guests have mentioned, Beijing has telegraphed this very carefully, that they want this to be a very managed and, to be so bold, a very staged G20. Now, I think different actors, Japan, the United States, and others, maybe on sidelines of the conferences, are going to want to talk privately to Beijing about the South China Sea. Specifically, there's a lot of rumors floating around Washington and other regional capitals that China may make its move after the G20 is over. Keep in mind, the United States is going to be very distracted with our presidential election of whether we're going to pick Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton as our next commander-in-chief. So if China was going to make some sort of escalatory move in the South China Sea, whether declaring air defense identification zone, reclaiming Scarborough Shoal from the Philippines, or doing some other sort of escalatory move in the region, this would be the time to do it. So I think it's a very important thing that President Obama or maybe Shinzo Abe and other regional leaders really emphasize to Xi Jinping that this isn't the time to sort of make any escalatory moves, and that we all need to move to some sort of new regional dynamic where there's peace.
And that was Harry Kazianis of the Center for the National Interest. To watch the full show, you can go to voanews.com/#VOA or check out my Facebook profile, Michael.Lippin. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Scientists working with what has been purported to be the world's most sensitive dark matter detector say that despite spending 20 months looking for the mysterious stuff, they have not been able to detect even a single trace of it. The large underground xenon dark matter experiment was conducted at the Sanford Underground Research Facilities, located beneath about 1.6 kilometers of earth and rock in the Black Hills of South Dakota. The Lux scientists say their detector was so sensitive that if any dark matter particles had actually interacted with their device, it would have certainly pointed them out. The researchers say their experiment gathered and then later analyzed nearly 500 terabytes worth of data. Findings from the Lux experiment will be used to help those conducted in the future, such as the Lux Zeppelin experiment, which is expected to continue the search for dark matter in 2020. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. Well, you know, some pop tunes have a serious message. One of them is a new single by a young woman from Canada, as International Edition's Sarah Williams found out when she spoke to VOA Border Crossings host Larry London.
Today we're going to shine the spotlight on a 20-year-old pop star who is on the rise. She's from Canada, and her name is Alicia Cara. And she came on the scene about a year ago with a song which she put out called Here, which was actually written because of a party. It's about a party that's going not too well. She's not happy, and what am I doing here? And so she was inspired by an actual experience. In fact, the music video featured some of her friends who attended the party with her. And then she made it big a year ago on the pop charts, and then followed that with Wild Thing. She was on tour this past year for her debut album, Know It All, and now she's out with her third single. Actually, fourth, but that's not what we're going to feature today. Today we're featuring the third single because it carries a social message with it.
And what is that social message?
Well, okay, I'm glad you asked. The social message, well, first of all, it'll be pretty obvious when I tell you the song title. The song is called Scars to Your Beautiful. Now, there seems to be an ongoing movement now with a lot of different stars and celebrities who are in the spotlight to bring attention to the fact that we don't have to look beautiful to be beautiful. And it's body image, self-awareness, that seems to be the in thing now. In fact, Alicia Keys and Alicia Cara both went to the MTV Video Music Awards show Sunday without makeup. And it was their statement to say that women in particular are judged by how they look. And they want to say that you can be beautiful without getting all made up and fancy hair and makeup and accept people the way they are. Now, this particular song for Alicia Cara, Scars to Your Beautiful, features a bunch of people who've had different, shall we say, physical imperfections, scars, physical scars, and also some emotional scars, too. But it's just like a montage of different people's faces. And, it you know, everybody's kind of there as a statement to you can be beautiful with scars.
She just wants to be beautiful. She goes unnoticed. She knows no limits. She craves. attention she praises, an image she prays to be sculpted by the sculptor.
There are a number of pop stars from Canada.
It's amazing. Justin Bieber and The Weeknd and Drake, and the list goes on. And you can add Alicia Cara to that list now. And in fact, in her own country, Canada, Ontario, Canada, she won the Juno Award this past year for Breakthrough Artist of the Year. The Juno Awards are equivalent to the Grammys for Canada. And so she's been nominated for all kinds of awards, has won quite a few. The Much Music Video Awards gave her Best New Canadian Artist. And she was just nominated on Sunday at the MTV Video Music Award Show for Best Pop Video for her previous single, Wild Things. She did perform the new single with Troye Sivan on the show. And she's only 20, and she's already getting started. She got discovered at 13 by posting videos on YouTube.
Wow.
Which seems to be the thing to do these days if you want to get discovered. So she did that. She's been writing songs since she was about 10. Very talented young lady. I had her on Border Crossings. A pleasure to talk to her. And she is going out on tour with Coldplay. So that's a big act to get a lot of exposure with as they continue their European tour.
Yeah, and varying age groups, I think, among the fans.
Exactly. And one thing that she did tell me when I interviewed her is that her brother, she's got a younger brother who likes to say, "I'm Alicia's brother," and he signs autographs as her younger brother. So he's enjoying the fame probably a little more than she is right now.
All right. Thanks a lot. That's VOA Border Crossings host Larry London. There's a hope that's waiting for
you in the dark. You should know. And that's a wrap of International Edition on the Voice of America. I'd like to thank director Tracy Carter and engineer Dan Crafton. You can find this show on Twitter at @VOA_IE. I'm there too. My handle is @Michael_Lippin. I'd love to hear from you. So thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Boko Haram terrorist group has one overriding goal: to seize as much territory as it can hold so it can impose its extreme ideology on the people living there. Beyond that, Boko Haram has no agenda other than to murder teachers, burn books, kidnap students, rape women and girls, and slaughter innocent people, most of whom are Muslims, said Secretary of State John Kerry during his recent visit to Nigeria. Boko Haram has a complete and total disrespect for life, the opposite of every religion. It has a complete nihilistic view of the world. It fears knowledge. It fears education. It fears tolerance. This story is repeated around the world. Wherever a violent extremist group uses murder, torture, and enslavement to force local populations into submission. And although such activity is abhorrent to nearly everyone everywhere, still these terrorists are able to recruit new members among otherwise peaceful people. There are far too many who join the ranks of these organizations because they have trouble finding meaning or opportunity in their daily lives, because they are deeply frustrated and alienated, and because they hope groups like Boko Haram will somehow give them a sense of identity or purpose or power, said Secretary of State Kerry. Derailing recruitment into terror groups requires a three-step approach. First, we must build public trust in governments and institutions by eliminating corruption, human rights violations, and other abuses of power, and by insisting on transparency and accountability. There is nothing more demoralizing, more destructive, more disempowering to a citizen than the belief that the system is rigged against them, said Secretary Kerry. As a bonus, once free from corruption, the economy will flourish, which will help bring about the second step, providing economic and educational opportunity for the young. And finally, it is important to build bridges of tolerance and acceptance, said Secretary Kerry. All of these efforts, fighting corruption, promoting good governance, promoting opportunity for men and women alike, showing compassion and understanding for fellow citizens even when it's difficult, said Secretary of State Kerry, all of these things will do an enormous amount to reduce the threat that is posed by violent extremism and to prevent it from reemerging in the future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.